Michael McIntyre, you might know him, he's a stand-up comedian. He does a comedy number about November. And he says how we all walk around for the whole of November saying, "Can you believe it's November? I can't believe it's November." Next Sunday is the first day of Advent. Advent just means the arrival of a notable person or thing. And when we celebrate Advent, the notable person arriving is Jesus. That's what we look forward to as we head into the Christmas season. We're looking for him. We're looking to him. And that's what Rory spoke about last week from Hebrews chapter 2. Today we're going to be looking at Hebrews chapter 12. So you're welcome to turn this along if you like, Hebrews chapter 12. Because I believe it will help us to continue to look to Jesus. And not just to see him, but to see him clearly. Hebrews 12 also shows us that the result of seeing Jesus clearly is finishing strong. So I've titled this preach, "Take a Look, Get a Grip." Take a look, get a grip. See Jesus clearly, take a look, and finish strong. Get a grip. Because if we head into the final month of the year and Christmas, seeing Jesus clearly, we can finish the year less like the vague petering out of an ellipsis punctuation mark, you know, dot, 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 and more like exclamation marks, brave, enthusiastic, happy, uncomplicated exclamation marks. Typically what happens in November is we all start winding down. We become dot, dot, dots, right? And we're tired, and it's end of year everything, and can the year just be over? Even though there's a lot of loose ends to tie up, oh well, let's just finish already. I'm always aware at this time of year of the tension that exists for my husband, because in contrast to that winding down mindset, it's actually his busiest time of year as an optometrist, because people still have allocated medical aid funds and benefits for optometry that they will lose in the new year, and so they quickly make appointments to see him. Some of you are actually putting reminders in your phone right now. Not so long ago, one of Murray's patients came storming into the practice, complaining aggressively about her contact lenses that had stopped working. And so Murray tried to calm her down, and he quickly squeezed her in between some other patients because he thought there must be some weird pathology going on, like a detached retina or something, because contact lenses don't just stop working, and you can't see a thing when they were working just fine yesterday. So it turns out she was wearing two contact lenses in one eye and nothing in the other. And she has a really strong prescription, so she wasn't lying when she said she really couldn't see much. The craziest thing is that she had driven herself to the practice. She did apologize for causing a scene. But we do stupid things when we're tired, don't we? And many of us are tired. When we're tired, sometimes we focus more on one thing to the detriment of everything else. We focus exclusively on something, and that skews and blurs the rest of life. Like where we should be wearing one grace contact lens in one eye and a truth contact lens in the other eye, we end up wearing two grace contact lenses with no truth lens, and that just blurs all the lines and distorts our view of a holy God. Or we wear two truth lenses with zero prescription for grace, and that makes us see everything in the straight lines of law and religion. Our vision is shocking, but then we still think we can drive our businesses, our families, our life groups and ministries and friendships, even though we're a danger to everyone around us. A friend of mine was woken on one hot summer's night by mosquitoes, and in the dark she reached onto her bedside table for the stick of tabard, and she smeared her arms and her neck and her face with prit. But when our vision is blurred or darkened, we take hold of the wrong things, don't we? So maybe we could choose to do for our spiritual vision what many people choose to do for their physical vision come the end of the year. And instead of resigning ourselves to just slacking off, like, can we just finish the year already, dot, 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 we could gear up towards a strong, clear, eyes wide open finish. We could see Jesus clearly, take a look, and we could finish strong, get a grip. So So I want you to know that I'm preaching this today because I desperately need to hear this stuff. We've had a difficult November, but I feel like we've still got 6 days to turn it around. And 6 days is long enough for God to create something new. He's done it before. So we're going to look at Hebrews chapter 12 and the first 12 verses with quick jumps to a few other related scriptures. Hebrews 12 comes right after Hebrews 11, incredibly. And of course, Hebrews 11 is the big faith chapter in the Bible. The writer of Hebrews gives us a kind of executive summary of Old Testament heroes of the faith: Abel, Enoch, Noah, Abraham, Isaac, Jacob, Sarah, Joseph, Moses' parents, Moses himself, Rahab, and so it goes. The writer recounts how some of these faith heroes were cut open with whips. Some of them were chained in prison. Some of them were stoned. Some of them were sawn in half. Just imagine for a moment that time warps were really a thing. And somehow you got to connect with one of these faith heroes somewhere outside of time. And they say to you, "So how's your week been?" And you say, "No, insane. You know, it's November, and it's just been end of year everything, functions for everything, appraisals, awards evenings. Plus, I've been late for everything because there are still roadworks on Atterbury Road. I mean, can I just catch a break somewhere?" And they say to you, "Shame. Yeah, no, it's rough. We've actually also been under a bit of pressure. My husband was actually sawn in half for his faith last week. And I managed to escape with the kids, but, you know, we haven't eaten. So, you know, just really just trusting God for that." The big point of Hebrews 11 is that all these people, they pleased God because of their focused, unwavering faith. And they were looking ahead. They were putting their faith in the Messiah still to come. We're on the other side of that moment in history where Jesus broke into darkness with blazing light. Hello, Christmas. We know that Messiah. So let's read Hebrews 12 and verse 1. "Therefore, since we are surrounded by such a huge crowd of witnesses to the life of faith," that's all the folks mentioned in Hebrews 11, "let us strip off every weight that so easily slows us down, especially the sin that so easily trips us up. And let us run with endurance the race God has set before us. We do this by keeping our eyes on Jesus, the champion who initiates and perfects our faith. Because of the joy awaiting him, he endured the cross, disregarding its shame. Now he is seated in the place of honor beside God's throne. Think of all the hostility he endured from sinful people. Then you won't become weary and give up. After all, you have not yet given your lives in your struggle against sin. You haven't been sawn in half," just saying. "And have you forgotten the encouraging word God spoke to you as his children? He said, 'My child, don't make light of the Lord's discipline, and don't give up when he corrects you. For the Lord disciplines those he loves, and he punishes each one he accepts as his child.' As you endure this divine discipline, remember that God is treating you as his own children. Who ever heard of a child who is never disciplined by its father? If God doesn't discipline you as he does all of his children, it means that you are illegitimate and are not really his children at all. Since we respected our earthly fathers who disciplined us, shouldn't we submit even more to the discipline of the Father of our spirits and live forever? For our earthly fathers disciplined us for a few years, doing the best that they knew how." I want to stop there very quickly, because it's possible that your earthly father did not do the best that he knew how. It's possible that you're here today and you don't know who your earthly father is. It's possible that your earthly father deserves to be in prison for what he did to you. Perhaps your earthly father at least owes you an enormous apology for failing you in some way. But what the writer of Hebrews is saying here is that by and large, dads love their kids. Dads are limited and imperfect, but mostly dads do the best that they know how. He goes on to say in verse 10, "But God's discipline is always good for us. Our earthly fathers might get it wrong. Our heavenly father never gets it wrong. God's discipline is always good for us, that we might share in his holiness. No discipline is enjoyable while it's happening. It's painful. But afterward, there will be a peaceful harvest of right living for those who are trained in this way. So take a new grip with your tired hands and strengthen your weak knees. Mark out a straight path for your feet so that those who are weak and lame will not fall, but become strong. Okay, so what happens when we take a look at Jesus? Think about this. If you get dressed in the dark, often it doesn't go well. But switch on a light and you can see, oh, oops, one black shoe, one brown shoe, and you can make a better decision. In John 8, verse 12, Jesus calls himself the light of the world. He says, if you follow me, you won't have to walk in darkness because you will have the light that leads to life. That's John 8, verse 12, if you're taking notes. If we keep our eyes on Jesus, the light of the world, if we look to Jesus, we actually see ourselves more accurately. We begin to see what we're doing more honestly. We begin to see as he sees. We see our sin, which is revolting. But we also see ourselves as our Heavenly Father sees us, which is a great relief. And keeping on looking to Jesus in this way strengthens us to get a grip, to keep going, to finish strong. Because when our vision is good, our balance is better, our aim is more accurate. There's less chance of us being blindsided by what the enemy throws at us. Our strength to stand is actually directly related to our vision. So you could try this at home. Stand on one leg and focus on a particular spot in front of you, like I'm focusing right now on Mel. And for as long as I keep focusing on Mel and I don't look to the right or to the left, I can stand on one leg for a very long time. I can be a flamingo, I can be a ballerina. But now, close your eyes and stand on one leg and try and be a flamingo or a ballerina. You might be able to do it for a while, but not for long. It's much, much harder. So keeping our eyes open and on Jesus, take a look, strengthens our knees, so to speak, and we're able to balance and aim and catch and throw. We're able to get a grip. It's difficult to do any of those things if our eyes are closed or if we're distracted and not looking where we should be. So again, if we look at Jesus, there are two things that we begin to see very clearly, and it's kind of a bad news, good news thing. We see our sin for what it really is, and we also see ourselves the way that our Heavenly Father sees us. Let's start with the bad news. The writer of Hebrews makes it abundantly clear that if we want to finish strong, we need to get rid of the sin that so easily trips us up. In 1 John 2, verse 15 and 16, we read this. Do not love the world, nor the things it offers you. For when you love the world, you do not have the love of the Father in you. For the world offers only a craving for physical pleasure, a craving for everything we see, and pride in our achievements and possessions. These are not from the Father, but are from this world. Most of what we trip over can be divided and sorted into these three big categories that John lays out here: pleasure, possessions, prestige. Another version of 1 John chapter 2 talks about the lust of the flesh, pleasure, the lust of the eyes, possessions, and the boastful pride of life, prestige. Pleasure is a good thing. God created pleasure. It's wonderful. But pleasure will trip us when we say things like this. I'm actually quite sad because my Instagram post only got 10 likes, which is actually a prestige issue. But because I'm feeling sad, I'm going to eat everything in the fridge. I'm going to start at the top and eat my way right down to the bottom. And afterwards, I will probably feel disgusting. But you know what? I don't care, because right now, all this food, it is pleasuring me. You can extrapolate that kind of thinking to all sorts of other things that bring you pleasure, momentary, dangerous pleasure. Possessions trip us when we say things like, Yeah, I understand about compound interest, and I know I can't afford the repayments, and I know it's stupid to go into debt, but you know what? I don't care. I want it, and I'm going to buy it. Prestige trips us when we say things like, I know what's probably going to happen if I go for drinks after work with my line manager. I know where it will probably lead. I know where he wants it to lead. But you know what? I need this promotion. I want it. I deserve this promotion and the prestige that it will bring me. So I actually don't care. I'll do whatever it takes. Let's ask Jesus to open our eyes. And by his light, let's be honest with ourselves. Let's see our sin for what it really is. What's tripping you? What's blinding you? What's making you lose your balance? What I find at this time of year what I do with my sin is I tend to just blame it on November. There are one or two areas of my life where I just feel I'm at the end of myself, I'm at the end of my wisdom, my patience, my grace, and I hear myself saying things like, oh, but you know, it's November, and I'm just tired, and it's the end of the year, and you know, as if it's not my fault that I lost my temper and yelled at my kids unfairly. You know, it's November's fault. But you see, November just shakes us so that whatever's inside of us spills out. November just shows me my heart. But the good news, and I'm so glad there's good news, the good news if we read on in Hebrews 12 is that we don't have to be scared to confess our sin to our Heavenly Father. We don't have to be afraid of His discipline because He loves us. We're His kids. If one of my boys comes to me to own up to some misdemeanor, I'm actually so glad and relieved and grateful, more than I am angry or surprised, because it means that he wants to make right with me. So if your kids step forward and they know they're going to receive your parental discipline, it's only because they love you and they trust you. They're leaning in, they're drawing closer to you, they feel safe within your discipline. And guys, we are safe within God's discipline. And I really want you to hear this. When God disciplines us, it's not God against us. It's God siding with us against our sin. It's God saying, I hate your sin. I hate it. It breaks my heart because it separates me from you. And I don't want anything to separate me from you. So I tell you what, I'm going to pay for it. I'm going to put it on my account so that you won't be charged for it. But let me show you a better way. Let me disciple you. Because actually, a discipled life is a disciplined life. Prisoners are punished. Disciples are disciplined. So if we look to Jesus, we rightfully understand our sinfulness. And if we look to Jesus, we rightfully understand how He sees us, which is cleansed and transformed from outsiders to sons in the house, learning from the Father. Back in Hebrews 11, we read this in verse 32 and 33. How much more do I need to say about all these heroes of the faith? It would take too long to recount the stories of the faith of Gideon, Barak, Samson, Jephthah, David, Samuel, and all the prophets. By faith, these people overthrew kingdoms, ruled with justice, and received what God had promised them. So the writer of Hebrews didn't have time to recount all the faith stories of all these people, but we've got time this morning to tell just one story. And I want to talk about Gideon, because Gideon's vision was blurred, and so his hands were tired and his knees were weak. He didn't have an accurate view of himself, and so God had to say to him, no, this is how I see you. And that put faith in his heart to overthrow kingdoms and rule with justice and receive all that God had promised him. He could take a look and get a grip. This story of Gideon has been so significant to us as a family that we actually named our youngest son, Scott, Gideon, after this Gideon. So I'm sorry if you've heard me talk about this stuff before, but I need reminding of it often, and perhaps you do as well. So I want to pick up Gideon's story in Judges chapter 6. The context is that the Israelites have repeated their pattern of forgetting about God and doing evil. And so God hands them over to the Midianites, who oppressed them for 7 years, because he will do whatever it takes to make them holy. He loves them that much. Marauding bands sweep through and plunder the Israelite crops and livestock, leaving them with nothing. So again, they cry out to God, and again God says, I'm your God, you're my people, I brought you up out of Egypt. Can you just try and remember that again? In his grace, the angel of the Lord shows up, and most scholars agree that this is a pre-incarnate manifestation of Christ. That just means that the angel of the Lord spoken of here is Jesus. So let's read from Judges 6 and verse 11. Then the angel of the Lord came and sat beneath the great tree at Ophrah, which belonged to Joash of the clan of Abiezer. Gideon, son of Joash, was threshing wheat at the bottom of a winepress to hide the grain from the Midianites. The angel of the Lord appeared to him and said, Mighty hero, the Lord is with you. Sir, Gideon replied, if the Lord is with us, why has all this happened to us? And where are all the miracles our ancestors told us about? Didn't they say, the Lord brought us up out of Egypt, but now the Lord has abandoned us and handed us over to the Midianites? Then the Lord turned to him and said, Go with the strength you have and rescue Israel from the Midianites. I am sending you." "But Lord," Gideon replied, "how can I rescue Israel? My clan is the weakest in the whole tribe of Manasseh, and I'm the least in my entire family." That's just Old Testament for, "I'm such a loser, there's no way." And Gideon really is a bit of a loser at this point in the story. So it's fascinating that the angel of the Lord greets him as mighty hero. Verse 16, the Lord said to him, "I will be with you, and you will defeat the Midianites. You will destroy the Midianites as if you were fighting against one man." The rest of the story, and please go and read it this week, is Gideon has a ram's horn. That's all he has. And Gideon is very ordinary. If he was a color, he would be hearing aid beige, okay? But he assembles the troops, and God says to him, "You've got too many. I really want people to understand that I did this in my strength." And so he gives Gideon instructions on how to whittle down the numbers. About 32,000 men go home, and Gideon is left with 300. And then he doesn't have swords and spears. No, he has a few more ram's horns and clay jars with torches inside, like burning sticks. Meanwhile, the enemy, it says in Judges chapter 7, have settled in the valley like a swarm of locusts, thousands upon thousands of enemy warriors. And Gideon has 300 men and some horns and jars and sticks. Then God says to Gideon, "I've given you victory over the Midianites. With these 300 guys, you're going to do this thing. But if you're still afraid, go down to the Midianite camp and go hear what they're saying." So Gideon and his servant creep down into the enemy barracks. And I just think it's so kind of God. He allows that. He works with Gideon's fear. So kind. They creep down into the enemy barracks and they overhear one Midianite saying to another that he's had this terrifying dream. And the other guy's like, "This can mean only one thing. The God of the Israelites is going to come through for them and it's overs for us." Gideon is super relieved. He worships God. He rallies the 300. And with phenomenal God-given wisdom, he implements an intrepid battle strategy. He gives each guy a ram's horn and a clay jar with a torch inside. And then he divides his men into three groups, kind of Shaka Zulu style. And they steal up to the Midianite camp. They blow their horns. They break their clay jars. They brandish their flaming torches. They yell, "For the Lord and for Gideon!" The Midianites are thrown into panic. They start massacring each other. And those who survive, you know, just flee. And they are pursued by the Israelites. Gideon is after the two kings of Midian in particular, Zeba and Zalmunna, because he knows that these two men killed his brothers back in Tabor. He finally catches up to them. And in Judges chapter 8 and verse 18, it says this. Then Gideon asked Zeba and Zalmunna, "The men you killed at Tabor, my brothers, what were they like?" "Like you," they replied. "They all had the look of a king's son." So this was the very ordinary guy, so fearful of the enemy that he was hiding at the bottom of a wine press. The guy who said to God, "Forget it, I'm a nobody." The guy who grudgingly obeyed. The guy who went with the strength he had, which was very little strength, very ordinary strength. And in the end, he had the bearing of a prince. So if you're anything like me, you're here today and you're saying, "I'm not a mighty hero. I don't have the look of a king's son, a king's daughter." Your heavenly Father is saying, "Yes, you are. And yes, you do. Mighty hero, the Lord is with you. Go with the strength you have." It's interesting that the angel of the Lord doesn't say to Gideon, "You have lots of strength," because Gideon doesn't have lots of strength. But he's got a little bit of strength. And he goes with that little bit of strength, and he goes with it, and he goes with it, and he goes with it, and he defeats the Midianites. So on the days when you wake up and you go, "Oh, it's November and I can't even. I don't even have the strength to get out of bed today. Never mind, make it through this whole day or make it until Christmas." On those days, you'll probably be right. You probably don't have enough strength to get through the day. Been there, done that, thrown the pity party. But here's the thing. You've got a little bit of strength. You're still breathing in and out. And looking around the tents, and I know that this won't be true of everybody here, but most of the folks I can see, most of you have at least one working arm. And if you wake up in the morning, you've probably got just enough strength to move the duvet like this. And then you've probably got just enough strength to swing your legs over the bed, stand, walk to the kitchen, flick on the coffee machine, eat just today's chocolate from the advent calendar, pick up your car keys, go with the strength you have, and go with it, and go with it, 5 minutes at a time, until you can get to the end of the day and go, oh wow, I actually did make it through this day. Oh wow, this is what it feels like when God does a kind of loaves and fish multiplication miracle, when I offer him my tiny little bit of very limited strength, and when I just keep doing the next right thing, and the next right thing, and the next, and the next. Back to Hebrews 12, in verse 2, the writer talks about keeping our eyes on the champion who initiates and perfects our faith. Gideon chose to keep his eyes on the champion who initiated and perfected his faith. He chose to believe God. He chose to believe what God said about him. And so he was able to take a new grip with his tired hands and strengthen his weak knees. He stopped feeling sorry for himself. He started behaving like a mighty hero. And he ended up looking like royalty. It's possible that you're not buying any of this today because you're angry at God. You feel let down in some way. You're not interested in seeing Jesus. You're certainly not interested in seeing your sin. You're not even interested in seeing yourself the way God sees you. You know how little kids will close their eyes and then they think you can't see them? I think we do that with God sometimes. We close our eyes, we shut him out, we close our eyes to the things of God, which is so silly because we know that he can see everything all the time. He's right next to you going, yep, still seeing you, still seeing you. May I say today, respectfully, if you're mad at God, please look at him and fight with him. Please wrestle with God because he knows you're mad anyway, and because wrestling requires that you get a grip on someone. It requires grappling. It requires close contact. It requires you to hang on to the person with whom you are wrestling. When you're hanging on to someone, it also helps you to keep your balance, right? So if you're here today and you're angry or you're heartbroken and you know your life is off balance, you know you're battling to stand, would you get a grip on Jesus? Hebrews 11 talks about all the prophets being faith heroes. Micah was one of those prophets. And I want to leave you with something that he wrote. I don't know if he wrote this in November, but I think he may have been exhausted. It seems a lot of people hated him. He had a big, unpopular, important message about God judging wicked nations. He also predicted the birthplace of the Messiah in Bethlehem, so he was also looking ahead to the Messiah. But although Micah is tired and people have disappointed him and he has every reason to be miserable, he's determined not to be an ellipsis. It's like he's saying, come on guys, we're better than this. We're not dot, dot, dots. He's wrapping up with an exclamation mark. Towards the end of his prophecy, Micah 7 and verse 7 to 9, he writes this. As for me, I look to the Lord for help. I wait confidently for God to save me, and my God will certainly hear me. Do not gloat over me, my enemies, for though I fall, I will rise again. I will get a grip. Though I sit in darkness, the Lord will be my light. I will be patient as the Lord punishes me, for I have sinned against him. But after that, he will take up my case and give me justice for all I have suffered from my enemies. The Lord will bring me into the light, and I will see his righteousness. Let's take a look and get a grip. Thank you.